here. Let me welcome you and tell you how fortunate we are today to have Dr. Kathy Gregg is going to speak to us. And Kathy was one of the first people we thought of when we thought of this, along with Tom Elkin, and to come and to talk to us about caring for caregivers. Kathy is married to Beau Gregg, who is sitting there next to her. Kathy is at UMC, gerontologist there. And Kathy and Beau have Sarah, who is 10, right? And Paul, goodness, Paul is 8, aspiring gymnast. And so we felt like dealing with just the physical realities was a key thing as we began this series. And so, Kathy, we're going to ask you to come up and you have with you, by the way, in the folders, you have Kathy's outline, where she's headed. And if you'll keep that and bring it next week when Philip Buchanan comes, then we'll add to it. And then when Tom comes, we'll add to that one. And when Billy and I come, you can erase it all and start over. But anyway, but come on, Kathy. Okay.
Hey, thank y'all for coming and thanks for having me. I guess they did ask me last fall, the end of the summer or something, about doing something like this and talking about caregiving and a little bit about that, what that means. And I was asked to cover sort of the medical questions and issues, which, as you can imagine, is a little more than we might cover in an hour. But we got together and came up with a few what we might consider hot topics or more pertinent issues that everybody wonders about or deals with. And so I'm going to start with that. And I think I've left plenty of time for questions. So if I confuse you or if it brings up other issues that you want to discuss or hear about, we'll have time for that. And anyway, I guess that's really where to start. So don't worry, there'll be time. And if you need to interrupt me, that's fine if something's not clear. So I wanted to start with just what is a caregiver. And in general, you know, it's a person who provides care. So some of us, we know certainly people in the church who take care of everybody, who that's their personality is to provide care for others, and they spend a lot of time taking care of other people, whether it's family members or friends or other church members. And we all do this with our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends. But for today, we're talking more about the family member or the paid helper who provides care for an elderly person. And so at least that's the way I use the term in my practice. And so we started with the topic caring for elderly parents, but it may not, you may not all have parents. You may have siblings, or you may have grandparents, or you may have, you know, we have spouses, sons, daughters, nieces, friends, other relationships. Wherever we are and whatever family members, you know, you can be called in upon to take on that role. And so that's kind of what we're talking about today, is just taking care of older people who need more assistance. And one of the things that we talked about when we got together and preparing for this was, well, when do you get involved, and how do you get involved, and what's the right time? And it can be a tricky tricky issue, because, you know, we're in America and we're all independent and we are private. You know, we have our business and you have your business, and stay out of mind kind of attitude sometimes. And sometimes, you know, and when it's parent child and you haven't been involved in your parents' business and now you need to be involved in their business, that can be tricky. So I was going to talk a little bit about that. From my perspective, from a medical provider's perspective, the earlier sometimes the better. So when you have a situation that's not critical, and we're not in a crisis mode, and nothing is going on that's serious, that's a good time to start getting involved, to have those conversations, what's going on with your medical care. And, you know, when I was thinking about this, I thought one way would be, you know, Mom, if something happened to you and you were in a car accident, I don't even know if you take medicine every day. You know, can we sit down and talk about, you know, do you have any medical conditions that I need to know about? Do you take medicines that I need to know about? And, you know, when you're talking about somebody who's very independent, you may not have any idea what they need or what their medical problems may be. So that's kind of a starting point I thought about. If you're talking about someone who has dementia, of course you're in a very different situation, and you can't do it slowly. You have to get in there. You have to get involved. You have to make sure that safety issues are taken care of. You have to make sure that that you do know what medications are supposed to be taken. You need to go to appointments. You need to understand the diagnosis and the condition and what the treatment plan is and prognosis and what your responsibilities may need to be. So kind of backing up of becoming a caregiver and being there earlier, even for independent and, you know, mentally competent, no dementia problems, someone, it's nice to have another set of ears when you go to appointments. And that may be more particularly when there's a big issue like surgery being planned or a cancer diagnosis or something, a stroke, heart disease, something that's big and is going to require more care. It's nice to have a second set of ears who can listen to the plan, because we all think we're listening and then we 30 minutes later go, now what'd they say about that? And it's just because it's overwhelming. There's so much new information. The whole system is overwhelming. Everything that you're going through, you know, checking in, waiting in line, dealing with insurance, getting this, that, and the other done, you know, we can't keep all the details. And so it's nice to have somebody else involved. A couple other things. Besides just learning medical conditions, medications, and sort of the whole prognosis, treatment plan, those types of information, another thing that's very important if you are a caregiver is, and really if you're a family member, is discussing advance directives. And I think Philip's going to talk a little bit more about this from a legal perspective. But from a medical perspective, when you have a patient, I'll talk from a doctor's perspective. So I have a patient that comes into the emergency room or has a stroke and is incapacitated and unable to speak for themselves. It doesn't really matter about the paper that's filed in the lawyer's office or in a filing cabinet at home, because we don't have time to get that. I need to know now if mama has said, don't ever put me on a ventilator. So those kinds of issues, I tell all of my patients, or I try to tell all of my patients, just be sure that you've told your spouse, that you've talked to your adult children, that everybody kind of knows what you're thinking about these issues. And advance, I'm kind of talking more about the, you know, living will and ventilator, tube feeding, antibiotics, all those sorts of things, the types of medical interventions that we can do. And that it's different. Each situation, you may be in a car accident and you may be on a ventilator for 2 days and you may be fine. And so, but, you know, some people have watched their sister or their mother or father or someone in an ICU for month after month after month, and they feel very strongly, do not ever do this to me. Even if it is only 3 days, I don't want it. But those are things your children may not know, or you may not know that your parent felt that way. And I dealt with a situation recently where a gentleman had a perioperative complication with his heart and ended up being on the ventilator and being resuscitated, all that. And months later, probably 6 months later, I was talking to his son, and this is not a patient of mine, so I don't know the complete background of the conversation before he became ill. But the son's comment was, you know, he didn't want to be resuscitated at all, and we've already done it twice now, and we're not going to do it again. And it was, you know, and I didn't have an opportunity to speak to the gentleman and know if that six-month period was miserable or not, but a couple months of it were spent in the ICU and in nursing home, and then after that, nursing home and hospitalizations. And so when we don't know the wishes, sometimes we don't make a decision that might be what a person wants. So that's something that's very important as a provider, that as a caregiver, you've addressed that you know what sorts of decisions would be in keeping with the patient's wishes and with their paradigm and their beliefs and everything that, you know, that they've expressed. And so, again, like I said, you know, different situations do make it, you know, there is an ebb and flow, and there are situations where you say, well, I might have it for this reason, but I might not want the treatment for that reason. And that's difficult, but that's the way life is. So, but if you can have these conversations, you get an idea, and it's easier to make decisions when you're put in that position. Well, she can't speak, so what are you going to do? What do you want us to do? What do you want us to do? And you're like, you know, put on the spot. At least if you've had the conversation, it makes it easier to discuss with your siblings or the other family members. Or if you're the only one, it's easier to say, well, she had said this, so I think with that conversation, I feel good about proceeding in this manner. Let's see. So those are kind of thoughts I had about when to become involved and how to become involved. So next topic, what does a caregiver do? And that's lots of things. Caregivers wear many hats and play many roles. And I kind of started a list, and y'all could probably fill in a lot more, but that may be chauffeur, and it may be grocery shopper, and it may be listener, an advisor, and it may be companion, and, you know, it may be actual hands-on care. So there's a progression when you know, we talked about getting involved when someone is not totally dependent, when they're still independent, and kind of starting that conversation early. Well, then you may not need to do much of anything except for kind of check in every now and then. How are things going? And is everything working out all right? Are you getting the information you need when you go to your visits? And then you may get to, let me go with you to appointments. And the patient may have more needs. I can't drive anymore, or I don't think they're talking. I need you to go with me to the appointments. Or I need you to buy my groceries. I need you to prepare my meals. And it may not be that they tell you that. You may have to pick up on that yourself and, you know, look at cues and signs that, you know, whether it's things like hygiene issues or missing appointments, repeating, not paying bills, things like that, mail piled up, signs that things are not going as they should. So, I was kind of looking at the stages we go through. And so I'm kind of going to go back through that. So early stage, you may just be there. Call me when you need me. Let's just talk every now and then. How are things going? And do you need me to run any errands for you? I'm going to the grocery. Can I pick something up? You know, do you need a ride anywhere? Those sorts of things. And then, you know, as it progresses, you may be doing more, and you may need to manage medications, and you may need to make sure that the medications are being refilled when they're supposed to, and that they're being taken as they're supposed to. Then you may progress to giving that patient their medicines every day and watching them swallow those medications. And it may progress to the things we talked about, like running errands, and then it may be assisting with bathing or dressing. And then, you know, as we age and as we become more dependent, then you may progress to doing everything, you know, all of the activities of daily living, bathing, feeding by hand, you know, helping get in and out of bed, those sorts of things. And so it's a broad range from just being a listener to providing everything. And just listening to that list and thinking about that, you know, it's overwhelming. I mean, it's a whole lot that you could be asked to do. And so there's help out there. And so that's the next question, is what help is there? And so I've got kind of a short list of things, and there are always other resources. I can't name them all, but private sitters. So you have in-home assistants where you can have family members take turns. You can hire people to come in. You've got home health agencies that provide sitters and nursing supervision. That is not a home health agency that's covered by Medicare. is not 24/7. It's not every day. It might be once a week for the nurse, and it might be three times a week for an aide, and it might be therapy two or three times a week. So it's not, and y'all may all have experience with this, but I feel like I need to cover the basics. But it does give you another set of kind of medical eyes to look, and then it gives you just some actual assistance if you have a home health aide through the agency. Then there's services like respite services. So I had a call today from a nurse about one of my patients who's in hospice.
Ms. McGee, can you call the office, please?
And they're going to the husband is caring for the wife, and he goes every year to Florida to visit his family. And so they're going to put her in a nursing home for 3 days, I think, so that he can travel and she will be cared for. And so that's a form of respite care. And she's in hospice, so that's a little bit different. But there are respite services through grant programs and Medicare, Meals on Wheels. There are aids for Medicaid patients. There are aid services where instead of going into a nursing home, you can get homemakers and certified nurses assistants in the home on almost a daily basis. There are adult day centers. So if you're the only caregiver and you're working, you know, that a patient can go to an adult day center and spend the day there, and they will provide meals and activities and medications and treatments, and then you are the caregiver overnight. So those are some things available. Then you can move to alternate dwelling places, like assisted living facilities, dementia units, nursing homes. So that's kind of the next step. And then another place we get to is hospice. And so that's, of course, another stage altogether, talking about end of life. But that's another place or assistance provider when you're the caregiver. So if you are in a terminal phase of life, the hospice services I highly recommend to people, just because of the amount of care provided and the emotional support in addition to the physical and the medical. So moving on to the next thing that we had discussed that would be that we get a lot of questions about, or just how do you do that? How do you find these things, and how do you start? And it's not always easy. I've got this book that I love that's helpful, and we put this in the library, Donna, Living with Alzheimer's. It's a book from the Alzheimer's Association, and it's geared toward Alzheimer's patients, but it has so much information that is beyond Alzheimer's disease that applies to all caregiving, and it has a chapter on how to choose a nursing home, and it has a chapter about care that you can get at home and about some of the resources available, and it has all of our local numbers, like the area, I don't know if we call it the Area Agency on Aging, the Department of Health, Division of Alzheimer's, things like that. So they've got a lot of resources in here and advice on how to navigate some of these things. And it is sometimes difficult, but, I mean, even through the State Department of Health, getting a case manager there that can kind of help you look at what services are available through Medicare or Medicaid, that's one thing, getting online on the computer and looking at different things, talking to friends, talking to family members, you know, about what they've done and what they've experienced. But if you're really, and that's kind of general and different things that are out there, then you've got one of the main points about negotiating is doing your homework. So you really need to look at what's out there. But first, you need to figure out what you need. So if you just need a little bit of help, that's, you know, one search. If you need nursing home placement, that's on the far end. So you kind of got to assess what your needs are and what your stressors are and what would benefit you the most as you're looking for help. And then you've got to look at finances, because that is always an issue, and care is not cheap. And just looking at in-home care, so if you had someone living with you that you're caring for and you need a sitter, whether that's so you can go to work and you need a sitter all day, or whether that's just 3 hours, three times a week, so you can do grocery shopping, run other errands, visit friends, do something for your own respite. You know, if you go through a sitter service, your sitters are licensed and bonded, and then if they're sick, it's okay, they send a replacement, so you're not left hanging. If you do hire through word of mouth, people who are out there, you know, so many of my patients just hire somebody that somebody else knew or whatever that lived down the street. It was their neighbor, sat with their neighbor or sat with their cousin or whatever, and so they find private sitters, which is great and actually can cost less. But if the private sitter's sick, they may not have a replacement. So it kind of depends, again, on your needs and what you're looking for. So if you need to go to work, you may need that to pay a little more for that guarantee of someone being there. But if you're flexible and it's just for you to go shopping, you might say, well, that's okay, I'll just stay home today, it won't be such a big deal. Or my sister's in town and she can come over and I'll go to this meeting I was supposed to go to, you know, or whatever it is. Very situational. So talk to your doctor. I mean, there are times that home health is appropriate. And, of course, you know, all the cutbacks and clampdowns, whatever, on what we're able to do through Medicare, it's not as simple as maybe it once was. But when conditions change, medications change, somebody's been in the hospital, those are times that Medicare does provide home health services. And they provide nurses, home health aides or CNAs, which can provide the bathing and dressing, that sort of thing, and then physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and some agencies have psychiatric nurses. So if you're dealing with anxiety, depression, dementia, you can have nurses that can monitor those medications and the effectiveness and side effects and all that. So home health is something that your physician can help with. Sometimes, and then when it's time to do hospice is another. And your physicians pretty much have to fill out forms for anything that you want to participate in, like adult day centers or assisted living or nursing homes. So you would be involved that way. But trying to see, hey, could mama get home health? Is this a situation in which we would qualify for that? You know, that's not a bad question to ask. And sometimes, you know, when we have a condition and we're thinking you're going to need to come in every week, maybe you wouldn't have to come in if nurses were checking on you at home every week, that sort of thing. And then let's see, I wanted to talk a little bit more about nursing homes. We had a lot of conversation about nursing homes when we were kind of planning for this, because it's in some ways kind of a big ugly and a big scary thing, and nobody wants to think about it, nobody wants to go there, but, I often consider it sort of a necessary evil, because we all are not able to have someone move in our homes to care for them until the end of life. And so a lot of nursing homes have moved toward rehab, so you get your knee replaced and you go to a nursing home for 2 weeks and you go home. And they love that because Medicare pays more for that. But we still need long-term care. And there are, you know, there are always going to be people who need to go there and stay there until the end. And so... just a few comments from a medical perspective about nursing homes that we thought might be helpful or appropriate. They're not perfect, and you already know that. You're not going to find the perfect one. You're not going to find the best one. And I've been practicing almost 15 years. I've heard horror stories about everyone, and I've had heard wonderful stories about every one of them, you know, in our area. And they go up and down. And so one may have been good 5 years ago, and it's not so good now because staff changes. And I may have a patient who loves this one this week, and another patient the very same week hates it. So it's just impossible to say, oh, that's the best one in town. That's where you need to go. And if you're in the hospital and you got to go to one, you don't get a choice always. You got to go where there's an open bed. So it's not like, you know, you can stay in the hospital until a bed opens up. So, part of that is sort of the expectations that that we don't get, or how do I say this, that we want to have realistic expectations. That it's not perfect, that it's not going to be great, and that there's good and bad everywhere. And so there are resources for helping to look. And some of the advice that I give, one thing is to go before you need it and look around so you're not in crisis mode and you're not emotional and distraught while you're looking at a nursing home, that you're looking when you're more clear thinking and more objective. and when you don't need it. And then you go at different times and you talk to the residents and you talk to the family members who have, you know, family members there, or family members of residents, what I'm trying to say. Look them up online. You can look up, I think, their state audits and see if they've been reported too many times for problems, that sort of thing. You can, let's see, take tours, ask around, talk to the nurses. There are places online. I think it was called Finding a Place for Mom is a website that you can go to and sign in, and they'll look at the places in your area and compare them. And then this book has kind of questions to ask and different topics to explore as you go there. You know, how do you treat dementia patients? What are your activities like? And looking at the residents, do they look, you know, clean and happy and entertained? Is it dark and dreary? Is it sunshiny and cheerful? You know, all those different things. And so I'm trying to think if there was another issue on that. There's several issues on nursing homes I wanted to discuss, so I've got a few more topics. But that's just some of the issues. Oh, it doesn't have to be permanent. That's another thing I really wanted to reiterate. If you get to a place and you're unhappy, you don't have to stay there. And it can be scary if you have to take somebody home for a while and find another one, or it can be very difficult and challenging to try to arrange a transfer, but it can be done. So don't feel like if I make this decision, this is it, I can't go back, it's over. And I mean, we all know people who have gone in and out. I mean, in my own family, my grandmother, I know my granddaddy took her about 3 separate times. I don't know if it was, may have been 5, but you know, would take her and then he'd wasn't happy with it and bring her back home, and then he'd take her back and then he'd bring her, you know, back and forth and back and forth over a couple of years, just because it's such a hard emotional decision. But it doesn't have to be permanent. You can find another one. And so I had a patient recently who wanted one, and there wasn't a bed, and they got a different one. And within a week, a bed opened up, they just left, went to the one they wanted. And, you know, I hope it's working out for them. I haven't heard yet. But, you know, they had done their homework. They had looked. They felt like this was the right place for Daddy. And so they had to do a temporary situation, but you can move. A couple other things that I didn't mention when we were talking about looking at assistance that you may get, several other things actually. Long-term care insurance. I mean, so looking at what your insurance does cover, because long-term care insurance can cover assisted living facilities and it can cover in-home nurses and CNAs, and so that can be very helpful. Some people have VA benefits that can be very helpful and provide it's their aides in attendance program. And so it's similar to long-term care, what they may provide. So they'll provide certified nurses assistants to come provide care in the home. And the other big thing is caregiver support groups. So caregiving is not without stress at all. And it's not an easy job. It's always hard in some way. And it's always, you know, emotional and stressful because you're trying to do something for somebody that maybe you didn't, you're being stretched because you're having to provide care that you didn't have to provide before. You're having to do things you didn't have to do before. You're having to think about things that you never had to worry about before. And so sometimes caregiver support groups can be very helpful. Some people don't like support groups and, you know, that's not their thing. They don't want to do it. There are several groups in our area, and so they all have a little bit different flavor, a different mix of people. First Baptist Church has one, Broadmoor Baptist Church has one, University has one, River Oaks, Alzheimer's Association. Those are the 5 I can think of quickly, and there may be several others, I don't know. But that's always a good resource, and what I find, we participate in the one at University because that's where I work, and I always learn things that I had, you know, tricks that people have tried and things that have worked for them or things that didn't work that they share. And so it can be helpful and beneficial. And there's always somebody there that has more answers, you know, like a social worker or a nurse or a physician or somebody who can, you know, you can kind of hit up for some burning questions that have been bothering you. And so it can be very helpful. So I'd throw that out there. And lastly, on what should I expect besides the difficulty of the situation, the unexpected. So as people age, we become more frail, we become more susceptible to infections, diseases, complications. And so some of the things we talked about when we were meeting that may come up, you know, we get frustrated when mama or grandmama or whoever's in the nursing home and they have a complication like a urinary tract infection or a pressure ulcer, and like, they're not taking care of her. Well, sometimes they're not, but sometimes that's part of the process. And when we're that debilitated and that frail, you know, it's very easy when somebody's trying to help you get in and out of a wheelchair, in and out of the shower, help you dress, to have skin tears and bruises. Because what if you're taking aspirin or Coumadin or Plavix? You bruise easily, right? And then you've got your skin is thinner when you're older, so it's going to tear. And then hopefully patients are being turned like they're supposed to and getting out of bed every day and things like that. But, you know, still they do develop pressure ulcers. And so some of those things are signs that disease has progressed and that we're getting more toward terminal stages. I mean, it's not always poor care is what I'm trying to say. So, but, you know, the word on that is be there, be vigilant, get to know the staff that are taking care of your loved one, be kind to them, be friendly with them, you know, get to know them well so that they know you and they know what you want, what you expect, and be supportive of them and appreciative of them, because it's a very hard job. As you know, if you've been doing it at home, you know how hard it is. So, one other topic I had thought of that may come up, nursing home placement. If any of you may have already looked into this and have heard about the 3-day stay, you know, get your doctor to put you in the hospital for 3 days and then we'll take your mom in the nursing home. That is Medicare fraud, in my opinion. But because you don't put somebody in the hospital for nursing home placement, it will not be paid for. The hospitalization won't be paid for, neither will the nursing home. If you are in the hospital for a medical reason for 3 nights, then Medicare will cover rehabilitation services. So let's say you have pneumonia, or you break your hip, or you have a urinary tract infection and delirium. Then, and you have to stay in the hospital for 3 days because you actually require that hospitalization, not because somebody fudged the data. You then may be referred to a nursing home for physical therapy and occupational therapy and strengthening. So when you hear marketing directors say, oh, just get in the hospital for 3 days, get your doctor to put you in, and then it'll be a piece of cake, that's true in a way, but it's not a piece of cake to get in the hospital for those 3 days. So because there's been a lot more regulations about what, if they'll even cover you coming in the hospital, when we put somebody in the hospital, meet a long list of criteria. And so you can go in for observation, but if you stay in the hospital for observation, that doesn't count toward nursing home placement. So that's a more of an issue for a provider, but I have a lot of people who call me and say, well, they told me if you had just put them in the hospital for 3 days, we could come on over. I think, well, that's great, but they don't need to be in the hospital. And so it's hard on my standpoint. I mean, from my point of view, so I just want y'all to know, if you hear that, it's like, well, if we get to that crisis, if we have that illness, then we'll know that we can call, you know, we can get to the nursing home. But and then hospice, I don't know how much y'all have experience, everybody's had with hospice, but hospice is a Medicare benefit that is provided to patients who are considered to have a terminal diagnosis and the life expectancy is left less than 6 months. Now, that doesn't mean that if you live 7 months, you're going to be kicked out at 6 months and you lose the services. But if the physician feels that the natural progression of this disease, the patient will not survive past 6 months, and certifies that, then you qualify. And hospice provides they pay for the benefit covers the medications, a hospital bed, oxygen, wound supplies, diapers if needed, pads, all that kind of stuff. And then it provides chaplain services, social worker, nurses, aides, sometimes therapists, equipment needs, anything that's related to that diagnosis. So it's a great benefit if you need it and you're not planning on pursuing aggressive life-saving treatment. So we think of it with cancer, but it's also appropriate in end-stage heart failure, end-stage emphysema, dementia, someone who's losing weight and just continuing to lose weight despite everything you do, you're not going to put a feeding tube in. There's a long list of conditions, neuromuscular disorder, stroke. I mean, so it goes on and on. But there are lots of diagnoses that qualify for hospice. So that's pretty much all the topics I wanted to cover. Any questions?
I've got one you were talking about on the do not resuscitate.
Yes.
Had a situation. My son had an accident, was in the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
He had presented the living will.
Mm-hmm.
It, unfortunately, we set it up. Weren't told that it had to be activated by a doctor's statement that
right.
A long time ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they didn't even pay attention to that, that it had been done, and he was resuscitated. And they say be sure that it is recorded on the front of the chart,
mm-hmm.
and not just
a good point.
Up in the back of the chart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because in an emergency situation, somebody who has not read that chart may be in charge.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They won't read
the nighttime coverage and flipping through the back. Of course, now everything's on electronic records.
So if you're in that situation,
uh-huh.
be sure that they get it on the front of the chart.
Right.
And I was also told, this is in Tennessee rather than here.
Okay.
Down in Mississippi, you can write your living will, and they have a sheet
mm-hmm.
directing it sort of as in a smorgasbord.
They do.
You can
check more
things mm-hmm. that you want done.
Yeah.
And I would like to know where you can get one of those sheets if y'all have one.
I can print them off the hospital website when I'm at work. I can bring one to you. But and Philip is going to talk more about that. So why don't we ask him to bring kind of the standard form? I know we have a standard at state. It's probably on the State Department of Health website. But they had a standard living will form, I believe, or a standard advanced directives form, as I believe what it's called. Right. And you can check about fluids, antibiotics, feeding tubes, ventilation, resuscitation, medications, you know, to be shocked. So you can sort of, pick and choose which treatments you would and wouldn't want to some degree.
And where can we get one of those?
Book. Okay. You can get it from the Alzheimer's Association. It's all online, so if you're a computer person and you just want to read it off your computer, you can do that. I had at the last support group I went to, one of the women in there said, I sure didn't want to print 138 pages from my computer, so she was glad to have a hard copy. But I got this from a social worker I work with, and then Alzheimer's Association keeps them.
And they have an Alzheimer's Association office.
They have an office in Ridgeland. I've got it on the back. You can look at that. But it's a helpful book to have. Anything else?
What's your opinion on?
We're not doing a high dosage flu shot. So I'm not sure about that. I mean, we recommend just the usual yearly flu shot, pneumonia shot at least once, the shingles vaccination, and then keeping up with others. So I don't think that's necessary to have a different one or a high dose one. Yes. Wait, there's a name for that. Is it boutique? Concierge, yeah.
where do I find doctors?
I would Google concierge medical services, but I don't really know where to find those. We're not doing a whole lot of that here. I'm hearing about it, but I don't know anybody doing it yet around here. And at the medical center, we all take Medicare and Medicaid. So I don't know about the other groups in town. I know some of them are limiting or, you know, stopping at a certain number or quitting altogether, but it's getting difficult.
You might not come up with this stuff,
Okay. Well, I shouldn't answer that.
That's not been discussed yet, but that doesn't mean it can't be.
Not with me. All right, done. Oh, that's a good question. So it's sort of the same services are provided, or exactly the same services are provided, just in different locations. So if a patient is living at home and they have a terminal diagnosis and they qualify for hospice, they can stay at home and receive all of these benefits. If they are living in a nursing home and they reach a terminal stage, they will receive all the benefits in the nursing home. The inpatient hospice, like we think of Hospice Ministries in Ridgeland, is, I think that's the only inpatient hospice facility that we have, really is limited to sort of last days, like 36, 48 hours kind of. I mean, and it may be a week, it depends, but patients who are in home hospice, the families can request, when we get toward the end, can we move into inpatient? And that works out. Usually nursing home patients don't move to inpatient because they're already in a facility, they have nursing, they have oxygen in the wall, you know, those sorts of things. But home patients can move to inpatient toward the very end, and patients from hospitals can go to inpatient. And then also now, at least St. Dominic and UMC, I don't know about Baptist, I'm sorry, I just don't know, have in-hospital hospice. So Baptist does too. Okay, I was like, well, you would think so, but I just didn't know for sure. So if you are in the hospital, frequently our patients are patients who have been in the unit and they're extubated and are expected to pass within hours. And they will move to the floor. Family can be with them. They get hospice service. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, but they'll get those hospice benefits in the hospital setting and not have to move. Because of age. Well, now wait, here's an interesting thing. Currently, our Medicare laws, or regulations, I guess you say, when you have a joint replacement, you have to go home nursing home, unless you're over 85, and then you can go to acute rehab. So actually right now you have to be older when you get your joint to get more service. So I'm not sure, we haven't talked about that yet. We haven't seen anything yet that it's really gonna happen. So I hope not, and I'm not sure. I think you have to go with your orthopedist advice on when to get your joints replaced. Anything else? Yes. Everything's okay. There aren't any problems. I think the things that we see are, you know, everything has looked fine, and then some, you know, a daughter or a son, it's usually when you have someone alone or you have two elderly patients who are kind of holding each other up, and either a crisis occurs or somebody comes and realizes there's no food in the kitchen, they're losing weight, they're not taking their medicines, and it may be memory, and it may be they just don't feel comfortable driving, or it may be a financial issue, so all kinds of issues, but it's more not realizing that the situation is precarious as it is. Does that make sense? That somebody's just barely making it, and with a little help could be a lot safer. And that's kind of what I see. Does that make sense? Yes.
What suggestions do you have for caregivers in dealing with the question of privacy, like a man's mother with child?
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, you know, I'll tell her this, and tell her, you don't tell me, she'll never be back.
That is difficult, and I confess that we don't do a very good job of being as private like that. We're not strict that way. We as geriatricians, we act more like pediatricians. If you're bringing mom in and you're coming in the room with her, we figure that's implied consent, that if she brought you into the room for the visit, you're going to hear what's going on. And if you were not supposed to hear it, you should have stayed in the waiting room, which is may not be, Philip might tell me that's absolutely incorrect, but when he gets here. But I do have lots of children of my patients who are very concerned about that, and they will write a note and say, please put this on the chart. You may talk to me. You may talk to my sister. You may talk to my brother. These are all of our names and our phone numbers. Let us know what we need to know. Or if we call you, we are the ones that can know. But I have heard from children of patients where they have been cut off like that and have had the same frustration that, you know, but if you don't tell me, it's not going to get done. If I don't know, she doesn't understand. She asked me later and I can't answer the question. So it does help if the, you know, if you get involved early and can have that person write a note that says, I want my children to be informed of my condition and my medications, et cetera, or you have my permission to talk to my children or my spouse or my siblings or whatever, you know, whoever that person may be, as necessary, sign and date it and maybe witness. You're the lawyer. You can tell me you probably need a witness on there, right? Or note, or have it notarized. So would be helpful because we may get more and more sticky with those situations. I know, but like I said, in our clinic, we just, if you come in the room, we go ahead and converse. And it's because it's like children. I mean, we take care of so many dementia patients that they are like with, you know, somebody, you have to talk with somebody who's able to remember and to provide the things that are necessary. Anything else? Yes. It's a very tough question because changes in environment can be very disorienting and can cause more confusion and behavioral problems and all that. I tell people a lot of times it is that you kind of have to judge it yourself. If you're the caregiver and you're the family, it's kind of you're going to reach your limit and then you have to do it. If you have safeguards in place and the patient is at home and doing okay and people are checking on them and there aren't any big issues like that, then that's okay. And it's maybe disorienting and difficult at whichever time. And then we've had situations where it wasn't a problem at all. You had this great anticipation of this horrible transition, and it was fine and went smoothly. So we can't predict for sure, but it just kind of, I go with doing what's best for the family if the patient is safe. And so when the time is right for the family to make that move, you do it. But if you lose any of the safety features, or the safeguards that you have in place, then you need to go ahead and make that step. Or if it's just the best time to go ahead and sell the property and do that. I mean, you know, you have to do what works the best. So. Okay. Well, thank y'all very much. I appreciate it.